Today is Wednesday, August 2nd, 2006. I am Sandy Thaler, an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Francis R. Wesley, Professor of Environmental Studies and Director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hello.
Hi.
We'll start the questions with asking you to talk about your early life, where and when you were born, if you would describe your childhood, your family, your early schooling. Were there any family members, teachers, or others that you saw as mentors or people who encouraged you to further education?
Okay, well, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and my father at that point was doing a PhD in sociology at the University of Chicago. My mother had a master's degree from Bryn Mawr in international relations, and she had done previous work in Chicago, and so they had met there, and she'd gone off to do her master's in Bryn Mawr. My father was served in the war and came back to Chicago after the war, and it was during the war that my parents married. So I was born in a university community, and you know, all my parents' friends at that point were academics. When I was in my first year, my father took his first and only university job at McGill University in Montreal. So we moved. I was about 11 months old. My brother, my older brother, and myself and parents. And my actual first memory was of falling out of the car at customs on the border and breaking my front tooth when I was 11 months old. So my first memory was of entering into Canada. So I grew up in Montreal, in an English suburb of Montreal called Montreal West, which at that point, Montreal was very segregated. French lived in some parts of town, English in others. And my father commuted back and forth by train to McGill. And at that point, McGill was still fairly small compared to how big universities have grown. And the sociology department, he was a sociologist, had many events. There was a picnic every year, and there was a Christmas party. And so again, many of my preschool memories are of attending university events. And many of my parents' friends were obviously professors as well, and who came to the house. And so I particularly remember, and this may have implications for what I do now, a graduate student of my father's who later became a professor of anthropology, a man named Jack Freed, who at that point was an unmarried graduate student. He used to come over for dinner to our house, got to be kind of friends with my parents, and he was fascinated by nature. So he used to take my brother and I out on these little nature excursions, because neither my parents were environmentalists. They liked the outdoors, but they weren't environmentalists. And he would, you know, show us, you know, how ants worked, and bring a telescope and show us the stars. And again, I remember those images in very childlike, idealized ways, but was very impressed by his view of the natural world. I went to a public school, always did quite well in school, and I think that was really the emphasis of my mother, who was extremely concerned about education and that we do well in education, obviously my father, but my mother at that point was a stay-at-home mother in a fairly conventional community of stay-at-home mothers, and she was a bit of an outcast, having, you know, a lot of education, and most of the women in the community didn't have any, and I think she was actually deeply unhappy at that point, because as an American in what was a very conservative Canadian community, we were kind of outsiders. My father was raised as a Catholic, and as many Catholics do who become intellectuals, kind of turned against it and was an avowed atheist. And the first week we were there and moving to Montreal West, we had a visit from the Ladies Guild of each of the three Protestant churches that were in Montreal West, asking which we were going to attend. And from the moment that it was announced we weren't going to attend any, because my father was an atheist, we were sort of outcasts. And And I, again, tell you that because I think it had a, something of an influence over my career as it developed. I can remember, you know, actually waking up from a nap as a small child and wandering out into a summer afternoon on the street where all the kids were playing and being surrounded by a group of kids who were spitting at me and saying I was a foreigner. This is because I was American. And not even understanding what that meant, but feeling very much the outsider. And so my childhood was preoccupied with, you know, two quests. One was to live up to my family standards, which meant that I should perform well in school and try to develop the capacities that I had. My parents were real free thinkers, and that also was not, you know, the case in my surrounding community. And the other was to try to find a way to overcome the outcast and become accepted into that community. So to figure out how to get along with other people, other kids. And I can remember as early as 6 or 7 actually consciously thinking of the fact that, you know, I had to figure out, you know, what it was that evoked the response that I wanted, and, you know, whether it was what I had to say or how I had to say it, and being very aware of that whole level of reflecting on the dynamic that was going on around me, I guess because it was really quite important to me at that point. And as I say, my father was working extremely hard, and my mother, I think, was deeply unhappy, and so there was a sense of having to fend for oneself in this rather alien, rather hostile world, actually, at that point.
Did it affect your brother the same way?
It was even worse for my brother, because my brother had, I think, undiagnosed learning disabilities and did not do well at school. And in fact, the first grade he failed, and he was 2 years older than me, but only 1 year ahead, and never did very well. And he had been born prematurely in back in Chicago, of course, in an era when infants were separated from a parent when they were born prematurely. So he was put into a nursery, and my mother didn't touch him for the first 6 weeks of his life. So I think that was part of the learning disability. It also meant that he and my mother had something of a troubled relationship, never really had a chance to bond. And I was a very different kind of child. The childbirth was easy. I was my brother, I guess from that experience of having been in the nursery, was one of these children who didn't cry ever, and because I guess got no results. So for an anxious mother of a first child, this was frightening, and whereas I was always very expressive, and so it was easy for my mother, and she bonded very closely with me. And then my brother didn't do well in school, so he didn't have that haven that I did, because I always did well in school, so I always was someone who the teachers liked. Now, that created animosity with peers as well, that I had to learn to manage, but at least there was some place where I was accepted, and I don't think there was for my brother until he got later into sports. But then he wasn't very tall, so he couldn't excel at that except for sheer ferociousness. And so I think he had a much, much more difficult time. But he was very good to me. I mean, when I was in the early days when my mother was really kind of depressed, my father was away a lot, I mean, he was my guide in that external world. And, you know, again, he told me to climb trees, and he told me to ride a bicycle, and he protected me if people were bullying me. So I was really lucky, and I think he took a lot more of the brunt than I did. So I went through elementary school. I graduated first when I left elementary school in grade 7 and had to give a speech. And got so frightened that I think failed to utter, or at least I just whispered the first and last time, I'm unable to give a speech. But I remember finding that quite mortifying. And I would say that another sort of pivotal experience for me was my teacher in grade 7, who was one of these absolutely fabulous teachers who everyone was afraid to have as a teacher. But because she was very strict and rather fierce, but who actually really encouraged the bright students. Now, I can imagine not being a bright student would have been easy in her class, but being a bright student was heaven to be there. And so she, you know, gave me all kinds of extra projects. I wrote a play for her. She let me do, you know, external reading. I remember for the first time starting to at that point reading Jane Austen, because she had all these fairly adult grown-up books. I mean, not in any way inappropriate for children, but beyond the reach of a lot of children, certainly not covering the curriculum. And because I would finish early, she would just encourage me to go back and read books. And as I say, I remember reading Jane Austen in grade 7 and it just opening a whole another world for me. And as I say, writing plays, wrote my own version of Murder in the Cathedral, but as part of a history lesson. She had us enter into competitions, and I won a Montreal-wide prize for creative writing that was given by a radio station, and I got to read that in public. And I had some kind of latent artistic gifts, which I don't know how she discovered, because I had never been aware of them before, but which she encouraged. And so it was just a kind of year of blossoming and feeling that I could do almost anything, although my strengths were very much in the arts at that point. I mean, I had done, my mother encouraged me to do a lot of creative writing, and so I had, had several poems published as a child, and I had, then began to take art quite seriously, and because of the encouragement of this teacher, and obviously writing the plays. And so, literature was my bent very much at that point. Never was too good at math, because I was never too good at math, somewhat discouraged from really pursuing science, and I guess a classic female pattern at that age. I don't know whether I could have done it or not. To jump way ahead, an interesting quirk is that in the last 10 years of my life, where I've mostly worked with scientists, I've worked with a number of mathematical modelers who have said that I actually think like a mathematician, which is something which I actually don't understand, because I have no idea how a mathematician thinks, because I never learned. I never went beyond basic geometry and algebra, and never took any other math, and only a little bit of biology. So I dropped out of physics because I was worried about how well I was doing in that, and so really had very little of that kind of background. Meanwhile, my parents were, experience mongers to some extent, and to a lot of trouble to introduce us to a range of rich cultural experience. I was very lucky that way. My parents started taking us to plays in Stratford, Ontario, Shakespeare plays when I was about 5 or 6, and they would read the plays with us, and then we'd go and listen to the plays, and my mother would read poetry because she thought I could be a poet, and so I started reading me poetry as a child, she went to art galleries. When I was 14, my father took a sabbatical and we went to Paris and lived in Paris. And we traveled all over Europe. We went to galleries, we went to concerts, we went to opera. I was in an international school, so I met children from all over the place. And again, the sense of, the whole world, which they, very much wanted me to have, mm-hmm. and the sense of us being a citizen of the whole world. And still big emphasis on the arts for me. I think my mother had me down as going to be an artist. I think she always wanted one. I was the most promising. I had at this point, I had a younger sibling who, if anyone's an artist, has turned out to be the only one of that generation, because she's a writer. And when I was in high school, and again in France, did very well in art, and when I came back to Montreal, I decided that I wanted to go to a school that wasn't in my immediate neighborhood for two reasons. One, because it had a French program, and other, because it had a good art program. And I can remember having, the first time I had an experience of standing up for what my sense of calling was actually in high school, because I was supposed to take Latin. It was one of the requirements. But I couldn't take Latin and take art, and I just felt very strongly that I really, really wanted to do art. And again, my mother was very supportive of that, and so she argued with the principal, and I was allowed to take these courses and have one of my high school leaving exams in art, because that's what I thought I wanted to do. So by the time I was in high school, I'd cracked the code. I figured out how to get along with people, and although in high school, I also graduated valedictorian of the high school. I also was a cheerleader, so I'd figured out how to play both sides. Sure. And my high school boyfriend was a football player, and I was head of the carnival ball committee, and I did all those things, which I literally did experience as camouflage, right? So that allowed me to live my external world, you know, as a reasonably popular teenager, from having started out as a very unpopular child, and yet at the same time still managed to do well academically because I figured the two things I needed to do. I had a little bit of a check in my last year of high school. In the fall, I was taking both physics and math and algebra because you had to take that, and I failed the only exam I ever failed in my entire career, which was a geometry exam. And my mother was extremely angry because this was when I was applying for colleges. She wanted me to go to school in the States. She wanted me to. I mean, they still felt very much like Americans, and she thought American universities were the better experience, and so she wanted me to try to get into a good American university. And so she was very, very upset about it. It was, you know, it was quite a traumatic moment. And I dropped physics because I wasn't doing great in physics either, and I doubled up on geometry classes. So I was taking two geometry classes at the same class twice. You know, and I got a tutor. And when I did my high school geometry, I got 98 in it because I had worked so hard. But frankly, I never understood it. I just learned it all by memory. So I never, you know, kind of cracked into that and left math, thankfully, at the end of high school and thought, I'll never, ever have to think about this again, right? So, you know, I always liked biology. It was the only science that I sort of caught into, and I did quite well in that. And did, in fact, one of my aptitude tests in biology and did very well on it, and you know, did the SAT test and did fine in all of those, and did very, very well on my got a provincial grading in my high school reading exams. So I applied to three or four U.S. colleges, Smith and Bryn Mawr and Middlebury, and went to Middlebury partly because it was closest to Montreal and partly because I got the best scholarship there. Arrived at Middlebury and went into some kind of shock because on a number of fronts. First of all, you know, I think the classic experience of having been at the top of your high school class in a public school and then hitting a, you know, a good liberal arts college and suddenly finding yourself scraping along in the bottom. And secondly, you know, Middlebury actually, at that point, was a school for the wealthy and the well-heeled, mostly private school kids. And I was young. I graduated from high school at 16, and so I was only had just turned 17 in July, and then I went off, and most of the entry class were 18 or 19. It was very unsophisticated. I really did not have, so I had, once again, the kind of experience I think I had as a small child of feeling like I was simply, you know, an outcast. I didn't fit. You know, I wasn't living up to standards, and it was very, very difficult. I mean, Middlebury was a wonderful, wonderful teaching faculty there. I mean, I think that like many of those liberal arts colleges, they attract people who really are coming from the best possible schools in terms of educations, but really want to devote themselves to teaching. Mm-hmm. And do they teach? And I was majoring in English and fine arts, double major. And the teachers I had were, I mean, I never encountered their equal anywhere. They were fabulous. So in terms of the academic experience, although I didn't do as well as I did in high school, it was riveting. In terms of the social experience, I was plunged back into, you know, the kind of anxiety. And as a matter of fact, by the time I was in my junior year, had what now in retrospect I think was something of a nervous breakdown. And I went back to McGill for the first semester of my senior year and went into therapy. My parents were great believers in psychoanalysis, having been in Chicago at the time of Bruno Bettelheim, and they were just believers that, you know, this is what any well-educated person need to do. They had been analyzed, and they felt that I should be. And so when I started having all these odd symptoms, that I guess now I would call anxiety disorder or something, but then I didn't know what they were. My mother said, well, we have to come home and go into psychoanalysis. So I left Middlebury for one semester, took a leave, went back, went into therapy three times a week, and sort of recovered. Went back, finished, And in the meantime, but, you know, and made friends, a few of whom I've kept, but never felt that that was my world, you know, felt more that it was an alienating experience. And it's only been over time that I've come around to not feeling a little bit bitter about the experience, and now see, you know, the real value it delivered, which was this wonderful education, and realizing that the sense of inferiority I had there wasn't particularly well grounded, because, you know, I've done much better than most of my classmates in terms of my life and career and all that sort of thing. And so, you know, you know how you see those things in retrospect, they don't seem to quite the black hole. But meanwhile, another wonderful experience arranged by my mother, if you can see, my mother's kind of pivotal, so, was that she had gotten, partly in her effort to overcome her alienation, and partly in an effort to address problems my sister was running into, because she had gotten into a fair amount of trouble in late grade school and early high school, and this was the 60s, and, you know, drugs and free sex and stuff were starting in, and my sister was intensely involved in all this sort of stuff, and my mother was very worried about it. She got organized to create a summer theater in Montreal West, or for high school students, a way to keep, and my sister had some interest in theater. And so, you know, there was a position as a director of this summer theater, and I got the job, and
this is after you graduated?
No, because I hadn't graduated from Middlebury yet. This was you know, kind of around the time I was falling apart. So it was the summer after my junior year, and the summer after my senior year that I did. I did this for two summers. So I took this on, not knowing a thing about theater, again, a theme in my life, other than having written that play. I'd never acted, I'd never been in school productions, I knew nothing about it. But I thought this would be a great summer job, and it was a transformative moment for me. So I just took out a lot of books about how to direct the theater, and I took this on and decided that, you know, this was going to be wonderful. And of course, because I knew nothing, I didn't know anything about limits either. So I took on some fairly ambitious plays. I took on one summer we did Alice in Wonderland, and another summer we did one of Girardeau's plays, Ondine, and then another short production. And, you know, as kids, we had a very, you know, gifted group of kids who turned up to want to do this. And what was interesting was that this was one of those pivotal experiences for them, because about 80% of them went on into professional theater out of this, and went off to go to school in England, and then came back. I mean, it was really produced a huge wave of. And so, you know, I took this play theater, and of course turned out to have quite a gift for it. It was, but, you know, going back to that little thing about how did I fit in, for me a pivotal moment was working with some of these kids, and they were as young as 13 and up to about 16, to try to get them to inhabit their parts. And I remember one day sitting with a kid who was a jock. He was, I don't know why he turned up for this at all, but I think he was enamored of one of the girls who turned up. And so he was a football player, a jock, and he turned up, and because, you know, I had to choose what I had, I cast him in this role in Ondine of a judge who has to try, I can't even remember quite the detail of it, but, you know, she is tried as a witch, and so the judge has to make a sort of metaphysical judgment about whether or not, you know, she's evil or she isn't evil. She was like, it's the Little Mermaid story turned in. Well, I mean, you know, this is a jock, right? And he comes to the speech, it's rather beautiful, as the French do it, a very beautiful speech about, you know, the sense of another world, the metaphysical, and how you sense its presence in the immediate, the contemporary, and this kid would get up and say, you know, like a 12-year-old jock would say it, and it was terrible. And so I took him aside and I started to say, I have to find a way. And so I sort of tried to explain, didn't get anywhere. And then it occurred to me, I have to find an experience in his life where somehow he felt those things. You know, he felt the sense of something ominous that was close to him. And so I just started talking to him. I was really interviewing him and trying to find, you know, where had he had that experience. And you know, now and then I think, well, maybe he now understands, we'd get up and do the part, and he still wouldn't do it. And at last, and I can't remember what it was, but it was something to do with sports, we found an experience that he'd had, which I thought was the emotional equivalent of what this judge was trying to describe. And he stood up and he did it as if he was that person. It was amazing. And I thought, well, it's just a question of finding that key. It's all a question of knowledge transformation, where you find these connecting points. And if you can find it, anybody can inhabit, you know, the space of anybody else, because you couldn't have thought of anybody more unlikely than this 12-year-old jock and this 60-year-old French philosophical judge talking about metaphysics, and yet, you know, he inhabited it. And we had professional level reviews, which I think one of the reasons why these kids all went on. We had newspapers came and reviewed it. We got very good reviews. And the other pivotal moment for me was an experience I had of the first night, and I think it was in Undine, or it might have been in Nelson, I can't remember which, where, you know, I pushed them and I worked with them and I rehearsed with them, and, you know, and I had to think about the lighting design and the stage design, and I had to learn about all these things so I could get these kids to do them. And then, you know, the first and the dress rehearsal is often the way they were terrible, and I went back and I railed, and then, you know, it was all over, and I was standing up in the lighting booth listening, and they got up and something happened, and they just took off, and they took it to a place where I couldn't have gone. And I remember sitting there and having this kind of bittersweet feeling of, you know, what they're doing now, they couldn't have done without me, but it's not mine. It's theirs, because I couldn't do what they're doing. You know, it's sort of, it's their own magic. And this really influenced me in terms of what I wanted to do in my life. And although, you know, we still have an interesting path to follow here, that was another pivotal experience. So then I kind of knocked around. I graduated. I did this summer job, and then I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought at that point, well, maybe I wanted to go into theater education because I'd had this experience. And so I went to Jordan for just a job working in a library at McGill, full-time working. I was in reserves, and they had some positions in reserves, and there was a bunch of rather odd sort of misfits. Kind of nice. I met a few people who've gone on to be my friends for life, but an odd assortment. And I liked the job because it was so easy for me to do it, and I could do what I was supposed to do in a week in about half a day, and then I could wander off into the stacks and read things. And, you know, I liked the people. But meanwhile, I'm thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I thought about medical school, and because I thought, you know, I wanted to make a difference, and I thought about theater, and I did apply, put together a portfolio, applied for the director's program at Boston University, and got in, and then I can't remember why I decided I wasn't going to do that. Oh, I guess perhaps because I was back in analysis, and I just wasn't quite ready to leave Montreal because I was in analysis from having started it, and I continued it on. And then, just out of desperation one day, thinking I had to do something, I thought to myself, well, you know, what can I do? What do I know how to do? Irrespective of credentials, and that one was directing theater, but I'd sort of decided, wasn't sure I wanted to go that route because I wasn't sure I wanted to spend my life there because I thought it's a little too unstable for me. I like, you know, I'm not sure I can live with theater types all my life, and even though I think I love it. So I just thought, well, sociology. My parents, I'd never taken a sociology course. This is going to be the thing. My parents are sociologists. Surely I can do sociology. So I applied to McGill, where my father was still a professor, but he in fact had moved out and he was working in the industrial relations sector, but that's where I was, and I wanted to stay in Montreal, so I applied there and got in for a qualifying year. In between that I did do a teaching training at McGill, so I had a teaching diploma, and that was also in theater, but then I decided I didn't want to teach in high schools because I didn't want to be fighting with people all the time. It wasn't like the summer theater, you know, and I just thought I don't want to do that. So then I applied to sociology, got into sociology. In the meantime, I had worked for a summer as a journalist for a daily newspaper that was in the Eastern Townships, near Montreal, but also thought of journalism, but decided not to do that because I didn't really want to live with journalists all the time because they got drunk too much. And I just thought, I just don't think I can live these hours and stuff. So I thought, I think I've got to go into professions, obviously. The sensitive lifestyle issue that I had. And so I decided I ought to, you know, try for academics. And so I thought sociology was my best bet. And so I plunged in, and they took me, and I did qualifying year, but I did very, very well in it. And you know, they accepted that as the first year for my master's. And then I did my second master's, and I did, you know, second year of the master's, and I decided to go into popular culture and wrote a dissertation on Charlie Chaplin. So not that far removed, right, from what I'd done, but moving more over into the social side. Then I went into the PhD program there, and I decided that I wanted to move into the sociology of religion because I was really interested in the cultural side, again, because of the background I had. And so I bought in the process of getting involved in a big research project on new religious movements as a research assistant, I discovered a group of new religious movements, this is the 70s now we're talking about, that were called human potential movements. And what's interesting about that for future choices is that human potential buy on and the human group dynamic stuff in Tavistock in England. And just hold on a second, I'll just hold up. Thank God. And which does have implications for where I went in the future, but I was interested in them as kind of cultural manifestations, and wrote a thesis on, you know, the whole notion of the cult of the individual and these human potential movements. And they used a lot of group psychology techniques, but they had a religious dimension that, you know, it's groups like ESC and Eureka and psychosynthesis. And so I was very interested in Durkheim's theory as a sociologist, and so, you know, wrote this, my dissertation around that. Finished very quickly, although I gotta say I thought I was wasting a lot of time. I tend to have, you know, patterns of work which are sort of very intense and then lying fallow. And so I actually got my PhD, finished it in 3 years.
And how old were you then?
Okay, so how old was I? I was 20 when I graduated from university, and then I worked for years, so I was 21, then I did the teacher's thing, so then I was 22, started in my master's when I was 22. I would have just turned 23, and so 23, finished first year of master's, 24, finished second, 25, 26, 27. Okay, so then I was 27 when I graduated. So also in the New Religious Movements project, I met my husband, who was director of that project at that time. He was going through a divorce. He was in comparative ethics and religion. And so we got together not right away. I was after I graduated and took a job immediately working at University of Western Ontario in the sociology department. And we were married at Christmas of that year. Had a commuting relationship for about 3 years.
Yeah, it was a faculty position.
I was tenure track faculty position in sociology, and I was teaching introductory sociology, which was a huge lecture class, and I sort of developed a kind of appetite for big lecture classes then. Did very well at teaching. Again, my father was, at this point, was a big influence on it. My father was a really, really amazing, still legendary teacher at McGill. All my young adulthood, I would have people come up to me in the streets. Oh, I was in your father's class. And so he sort of tutored me about how to teach, and it was very, very helpful in that. And I guess at that point, I'm sort of switching over from my mother to my father in terms of this kind of influence. And obviously he was a sociologist, so I was following in his tracks, although his areas were deviance and criminology and areas like that. I was teaching family and popular culture and introductory sociology at the University of Western Ontario, and, you know, thinking I was moving along what was a fairly regular path. I was publishing and thinking about getting tenure, but I started to have children then. So my first child was born in February of my second year at Western, and I took a maternity leave and went back to Montreal because we were still living separately, and spent the summer there with my first child. My second child was born fourth year I was there in January. And when I was pregnant with her, I began to think about the fact that this wasn't going to be sustainable, and he wasn't finding a job there, and you know, I had to think about, you know, maybe I could get a job back in Montreal. And at that point, my father said to me, why don't you look at management? Because he had moved into doing some consulting. He moved out of university, he was doing consulting. And he said, why don't you look at management? Because, you know, management's a new discipline. It's not as orthodox as sociology. You know, there's lots going on, and it's kind of open and freewheeling and sort of creative. And why don't you think about that? So I thought, what does that mean? How would a management? I don't know what it meant. He said, go talk to some people in the management faculty. So and he knew at McGill who were the sort of famous people there. So he gave me their names. And so I went around and talked to some of these people, and I thought, yeah, well, this is really interesting. And the last person I talked to was the dean, who actually was an admirer of my father's. I think had taken courses from my father. So he sort of talked to me because he was a big fan of my father's. And I was like, yeah, I'm sort of thinking about trying to make a move. And he said, well, he said, I happen to know that the big funding, our equivalent of NSF in Canada, is the Social Science and Humanities Research Council. And they were coming out with a new program called Management Reorientation Fellowships. He knew it because he'd been part of the committee that was setting it up. And it was about to be announced. And because the business schools were growing so quickly, they couldn't find PhDs from Canada. And there was this, you know, there was a big emphasis in the Canadian government around hiring Canadians. So they were offering to pay 3/4 of the salary for 2 years for people from other areas who were going to reorient in management. I mean, it was like one of these amazing sort of synchronicities. So I said, well, I don't know, why would they pick me? So I took my nerve in my hands and said, well, would you recommend me to this program? And he said, well, all right, given who you are. It was, you know, blatant use of leverage there. But I thought, how else am I going to get into this? I'd never taken a business course. I didn't have a single person. I was not a family who'd ever been in business. We were all academics. I mean, so I applied, and I don't think I ever would have been accepted at the time. But I got in because it was the first year, and they didn't know what they were doing. And they didn't even have any requirements. In future years, you had to do an MBA while you were taking this. And I never could have done that because I couldn't have passed finance and accounting because I had no math, right? But they took me, and I said, okay, well, fine, at least we'll be united as a family for 2 years. I got a leave from University of Western Ontario, and I plunged in. Now, I have to tell you that I did not know what the initial CEO stood for, and I didn't know the meaning of the term bottom line. That's how ignorant I was of anything to do with business, right? So the first semester I was there, I was sort of just hanging around, and I went to the classes of people who, you know, I'd heard were fabulous teachers, and was just trying to make sense of it. And one of the people who my father had pointed me towards was a man who's one of the business gurus in Canada, a guy named Henry Mintzberg. And Henry Mintzberg is a real original. He was an engineer, got his degree from MIT, and then went and did a PhD in management, one of the first. But he was just one of these completely free thinkers, and as a person, completely without pretension, I would say. And he's the kind of person that if he heard a 2-year-old had a good idea, that the chairman of General Motors ought to hear, he'd have no trouble saying, yeah, you know, I need to get the two of you together. He just didn't, he was nothing pretentious about him. And he and I hit it off. He thought I had good ideas, and even though I knew nothing about management. And so at Christmas time of the first year of these 2 years, he offered me a faculty position in the strategy area in management. Well, I figured I had to take it. I was not happy about taking it. I remember walking, you know, when he asked me, I said, well, why would you want to hire me? I mean, I know nothing about business. And he said, well, because you have good ideas. And then I walked home crying because I thought, oh, I really like living in London and I don't know anything about business. I don't even know if I want to be in business, you know. Well, but I have to do it because I've got to get my family back together again somehow or other. So I took it, and that's when not knowing what a CEO and what the bottom line was a real problem, because I had to start teaching, right? And that was very stressful. However, fortunately, in business, they have this thing called the case method, which is also a teaching style I'd never tried. But as you can see, I don't stop doing things just because I know nothing about them. This has now characterized my life. And to be honest, I think it went back to those early experiences in Montreal West. I began to feel that these were all just codes that you had to crack. They were knowledge worlds that you just had to figure out what were the basic elements. And if you could figure that out, sometimes knowing nothing else was a major advantage because you could ask questions and make contributions that people who had grown up in that world didn't know. And so it was like I had at this point kind of figured out a sort of core competence. It's like I can do that. I can figure that out and I can make a contribution which is that of the outsider wherever I am, as long as I'm prepared to stay at that level. So my father entered back into the picture at this point because he was running this consulting company, and so he said, well, come on, you can do some work for us and you can learn something about businesses. So I was a qualitative researcher, so I started working on projects where you had to do interviews and do data analysis and stuff, and learned a lot very quickly. And they also wanted to run, they had a lot of consultant clients at this point, and they wanted to design something which they were calling the Facilitators College, which was about training people. They had a particular approach called socio-technical systems redesign. Very complex analytic academic approach. Again, interestingly enough, came out of the Tavistock Institute, a man named Eric Triss. And so they wanted to train people in some of the capacity to do these kinds of system analyses and facilitate teams and design teams. So I interestingly enough, was able to draw on some of the stuff I'd learned from looking at human potential movements. And of course, being in psychoanalysis was one of the best educations I ever had, because it did teach you to understand dynamics, to understand levels of analysis and how they related to each other, whether it was emotional. So that code cracking and movement of information across levels was something which I learned as much about in analysis as I did, you know, learning about human potential movements. Now I was moving into management, and I tried to start trying to design these colleges which were highly experiential and highly skill-based, which was not something I'd ever taught, but which I kind of knew instinctively. And in the business school, I was put into teaching introductory strategy courses where you were using cases. And the great thing about cases was there were case notes. So I actually had all the answers, which I learned just before I went into the classroom, because I didn't know anything about this stuff. And when I hit things I really didn't know, it was a Socratic method. So if some financial issue would come up in the case, I would say, well, who out there in the class has the answer to this? Because I didn't have it. And I knew enough about knowledge and dynamics that I could get the class to solve the problem, even if I couldn't solve it, right? So I was using those skills. And then on the other side, I was teaching in an organizational behavior in an area that they called skills. And to my delight, what I discovered there was that a lot of what I knew in sociology, but that sociology never tried to apply because it was very ivory tower. Sociology still is. They don't try to apply it. And it's, you know, they're talking to other sociologists, basically. And in fact, they disprove. I've got a lot of grief from colleagues, some of it fairly offensive, when I moved into a business school, because they felt I was selling out, you know, and that I was morally bankrupt to do this. So I stop me if I'm not going where you want me
to
go.
No, you're good.
Okay.
You're fine.
So I started teaching the skills, and this was things like listening skills that, of course, I knew from qualitative methods, and there were things like team building skills, which I, you know, had to learn about, but I was also learning it through the work I was doing with my father in this consulting group. And a lot of it was understanding group dynamics, and, you know, I did know something about that, and because of the work I'd done with Human Potential Movement, and I understood some of this stuff around organizational design and stuff, actually, oddly enough, through what I'd done in this looking at human potential movements, because I hadn't taken even organizational sociology. I did know some social psychology, but I was way over in religion and culture. You know, I wasn't in the... So I started doing this and working with all these people who were designing these experiential programs and really learning a lot. And I was fascinated by the way in which business management faculties had figured out how to take this stuff to make systems work better. I didn't know any of that before I got this, and I couldn't believe it. I just thought, this is amazing. You know, you can actually design processes, a bit like directing a play. You can design a process so that you get certain kinds of outcomes. You don't own the content, but you can create a process that enables people who have the content to solve problems and come to certain kind of outcomes in efficient periods of time, and this is a real skill. And I was good at it. I think because of these sort of odd confluence of experiences, you know, I mean, I, first of all, because, you know, I basically first gone into art, because of having the psychoanalytic training, I was really good at, you know, decoding text, being able to move from emotional levels to interactional levels. And then I because of working in theater, you know, I knew how to combine whole sets of elements, whether it was light and setting and acting and the text itself, to create a certain sort of experience that I just learned on the way. And this is really what they were looking to do. So I became fascinated with this, but I also was very disturbed getting into big business. They didn't seem to me to be very humane environments, and I felt that the role, the consultant's role, was often one where you were really working to achieve, you know, to as a kind of a front for other things that people in power are trying to accomplish, and they really weren't sincere about the kind of changes, and people were kind of brutalized in those systems. And so, after having spent a number of years doing that and worrying about getting tenure, because I had to start all over. I mean, I was at the point where I could have gotten tenure in sociology when I left. I had the publications, but now I had to start all over and publish in management journals. And it was learning a whole new language, because I didn't know what a CEO was. And again, I remember a pivotal moment, you know, racing, because I had 6 years to do it. And it really was like taking a PhD, and I had my third child during that period too, so it was, I was multitasking to the extreme. I had two others, plus I had two stepchildren who were living with me a good part of the time. So I had five kids at home, right? So I was trying to do this in the sort of three-quarter time, right, because I really liked being involved with my family. And so I had to get this other PhD, and I had to get tenure. And to do that meant I had to be able to crack one of the top management journals. And so I was struggling to find a way to combine the theory with these management problems. And I wrote a paper called Microdynamics of Inclusion, which was actually looking at middle managers and their role in strategy making, and partly through the experiences I'd had with my father's consulting firm, understanding their frustrations and having an impact on this process and their sense of exclusion. And I used a framework which was drawn from sociology to talk about, you know, understanding middle management's role in strategy making. And struggled to get this right, and sent it to people to give me some feedback on, and got accepted in one of the top management journals in this article. So that was, I was cracking that, but at the same time had sent it out to one of my old sociology friends, who wrote back and said, "What's a CEO?" or something like that. You know, some pieces of terminology which he couldn't understand. I thought, I've done it. I've made the transition. I'm now speaking business school speak, but I've been able to bring the sociology in. So I made it through tenure with great sigh of relief. I'd done it. And then the minute I finished doing that, I said, you know, I've figured out all this incredible, powerful stuff that exists here in business to help businesses work better, and I just have no passion for helping businesses work better. So then I thought to myself, well, what would I like to see working better?
And I decided, well, I really care about conservation and environmental issues. You know, never done anything like this, but, you know, loved the outdoors, and my family had taken this, you know, camping, and my husband was a big outdoor person from the San Francisco Bay Area, and we'd started doing family camping and hiking and all that stuff, and I thought, you know, I really care about this. So what about if I figured out a way to make all this management knowledge work for conservation? So the only way I knew how to start to get involved in this was to do some research. So I applied for a research project on collaboration, which is a good collaborative strategy across different organizations in the conservation or sustainable development, which was the term that was going in the sustainable development domain. And meanwhile, I was developing a new course on strategies for sustainable development inside the business school. And I got funded, and I started looking around for collaborations between business and environmental groups and or government, et cetera. And somebody said, you know, you should look at zoos, because zoos have to do a lot of collaboration. So the Calgary Zoo, and one of my co-authors had moved to Calgary, he'd been at McGill, moved to Calgary, he was sort of in, he was marketing, but he also wanted to do this, so we sort of, you know, held hands and said, we're going to do this together, even though it was an encounter type. We decided to do one of the case studies at Calgary, and at the at that point, and these two things happened almost simultaneously, the director of the zoo in Calgary said, well, if you're really interested in collaboration, you should talk to this man, Ulysses Seal was his name, who was running an organization called the Conservation Breeding Specialist Group. And this was a subgroup of the IUCN, which is the World Conservation Union. And it was apparently a dynamo of action, and that they worked, he was just one of the extraordinary innovators, and he had created a system for zoos to trade animals, you know, for reproductive purposes around endangered species. And he was now starting up trying to create a template for running workshops for endangered species in the range country, so therefore all around the world, that would bring together all the different stakeholders, but using a computer simulation that was based on population biology and could predict extinction likelihoods over time, and trying to bring these players together to provoke them into making good policy around conservation of particular species. And I just talked to him. So I called him up thinking, you know, I'd get an assistant, and he answered the phone himself. And I was so astonished. I thought, okay, well, and I plunged in, and about halfway through my mantra about getting from this school, he said, well, I could really use you. And so he's just a legendary figure in the conservation world, an extraordinary man, and pulled me in such a central way, and of course gave me access for the research, but started to involve me, because I knew how to design things, in designing training programs for facilitators for these processes, designing workshops, and helping the organization strategically. And I became very close to him, and he was a genius. I mean, he connected people across the world, and he knew how to take knowledge that was in one place and connect it to opportunities somewhere else in ways that made a huge difference. And he had a follow-up, still does, he died, unfortunately, it was very tragic. He got a brain tumor, he was in his 70s, but he one of these people who should have had twice the energy in his 70s and most people in the 30s. And he was a huge influence on me, partly because he recognized that, you know, he'd gone as far as he could around the people side, he was a scientist, and he could see exactly where I could be useful. And then he made extraordinary use of everything that I could do for him. He made me believe that I could do almost anything. That, you know, if I took this on, you know, I could do it. And so pretty soon I was traveling all over the world, you know, helping these. And I knew nothing about science when I started this. Nothing. But of course, that doesn't stop me. Never stops me. I figure I can figure this out. Within a couple of years, I was mostly publishing with scientists in science journals. Now, you know, I'd published in humanities, I'd published in social science, and now I've moved into publishing in business, right. Now in science, right? So at the same time, shortly after that, another group who was working out of Florida, a group called the Resilience Alliance, and a famous ecologist, not equally equal, maybe more academic stature than Ulysses, but not so much in the world of practical conservation, a man named Buzz Holling. And he was putting together a group that had written cases about ecological systems over time and their link to managed systems. And he needs something, he needed someone who knew something about management. And one of his collaborators was someone working for, I think at that point, the DNR, but in Florida. And he had heard of Henry, because Henry was this management guru, and he'd read some of his strategy stuff. So we called Henry, and Henry said, well, not really interested in environment stuff, but I have this colleague who has launched herself into this new and odd career. And you know, she'd probably be interested. So I, that was in 92 or something like that, I went and attended this first big workshop, and became intimately involved in that network too, because I really clicked with Holling, and you know, I wrote a synthesis chapter pulling together the kind of management stuff around these scientific papers. So, and that was a group from all over the world who, you know, were really trying to think, thought, you know, marry, you know, knowledge of social systems and ecological systems and write theoretical pieces, and I've been so lucky. Because these two networks were the most extraordinary professional experiences, maybe after the summer theater was being the other one. And I had such an opportunity to talk to the brightest people in the world. And they weren't just bright, they were really value-driven scientists. They really wanted to see change happen. And they respected me, and they allowed me to help, and I could do just what I wanted to do in that moment when I said I want, you know, it was just like it was waiting. And at that point in my life, I began to think, you know, this is what the calling is all about. It's like you learn as you get a little older what you can do, and then a door opens, and it's an opportunity. And if it lines up with what you know you can do, so you think you can make a contribution, and it's an area that's important to you, you have to step through. You don't know what you're stepping through to, but you got to do it, because that's what calling's all about. I mean, that's kind of where you're meant to be in this moment in time, right? And it should always have that feel. It's not the same thing as saying, well, you just keep knocking at that door till it opens, because sometimes doors never do. And that's not your calling, if that's your experience. But if the door's open, it partly feels like something that's outside of your control. So it always has this risky feel to it. Because it's not just the door you decided to walk through. It's one that comes to you. But if it's a match, you just got to go there, right? So I was turning into a philosophy at this point, probably what I'd done all my life. But it was starting to make sense to me, because the best opportunities I had was when I would take this sort of step into an area where I felt like I didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. But I thought, but I have something to offer. I don't know anything, but I have something to offer. And they want me. Right, so they also think I have something to offer. But I don't know what yet, because I haven't figured it out. So I just have to go there, because I believe in this. I think this is important. So I had these wonderful, wonderful experiences with these two networks. But of course, all these wonderful experiences they do on the course. The last piece with the Conservation Breeding Specialist Group was that we took on a project where we were trying to integrate more social science and back into the kind of risk assessments they were doing, which were basically scientific. And we ended up writing a book as a group, which I was the editor of and also wrote about half of, which is called Experiments and Consilience. And we used the CBSG workshops as a kind of a, this is like action research, and it was a multidisciplinary team, and we would, you know, try to make a richer risk analysis by bringing to the table data that came from other disciplines. And we learned a lot about the impossibility of that. I mean, I've got to say, in any case, most cases, the experiment was a failure, but the learning was huge. Because what I began to realize, and what I hadn't realized till then, was that, I guess I knew it instinctively from the summer theater experience I recounted, but I didn't know it intellectually. I'd learned a lot about group dynamics, power behavior, interpersonal stuff, how you design things so that people can collaborate. What I realized in the course of doing that project was that some barriers have to do with the way we structure knowledge. It isn't just people getting along with people. It's knowledge management and transformation, and that you get knowledge is so differently embedded in different disciplines that just trying to put them together even with the best intention in the world, it's almost impossible. So if we're going to solve some of these big problems, we not only have to have to get the people to collaborate, we have to know how to find ways to integrate knowledge in problem-solving situations without taking 10 years to do it. We have to be able to do it much more quickly. So I got, in the course of that project, I got really interested in not only in the set of competencies that I'd learned around designing and facilitating for the people management side, but around tools and techniques that allow you to move knowledge, you know, across. Now, if you would ask me now, so what's my specialty? Well, there isn't a describable specialty now that corresponds to mine. In many ways, I have none. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I have publications in all these areas. I got a chair at McGill. I have, but it's weird. It's always been weird to me that I got those things because I've never done things in a classic academic way. It's hard to call me a specialist in a way that academics always are. But I think that universities are partly moving in the direction of realizing that there are new forms of knowledge production, often which occur outside of universities, which don't look anything like the traditional hypothesis testing laboratory scenario. They really have to do with these very complex multi-stakeholder, multi-knowledge integrations that require designs that are very different from the kind of research protocols that you usually see. And I happen to understand that through this weird set of natural abilities and circumstances, right? I just know how to do that stuff. And no one ever taught me it, but I know how to do it. And so that kind of expertise actually, and I'm again very lucky, incredibly lucky. You know, I was born with some of these abilities, things like pattern recognition that I'm just innately good at, in a time when those are valued. And despite that I was really counter-type, I've had a very successful university career. And I have to give credit to universities as being environments that adjust and respond and even are able to make exceptions even to their own rules in the interests of innovation and moving things forward. So, you know, I got the book, I had the one prize, and then Yuli got very sick and died, and that network has sort of dispersed. The other was Holling, retired. And about the time that was happening, I had another one of these open door experiences, which is that one of the people who I met when I was learning all this stuff about management was a man who works.
I had this other door which opened, which was that because of my experience with this David Cooperrider, who was, I had written, before I actually got into the environment area, I met him at a conference on sort of visionary leadership, because I also was interested in that. He and I had really hit it off, and I'd presented at a couple of these conferences on, I was still really interested. It wasn't specifically environment, I was also interested in some of these broader social problems. And so I had, you know, been interested in different forms of leadership and then interested in these things in the social sector. And he was starting an initiative called GEM, which was something. Anyways, he was really interested in business as an agent of social change, so he and I kind of hit it off. And the biggest private foundation in Canada, which is called the McConnell Foundation, had decided that they wanted to start up a program that was the equivalent of an executive MBA, but for the not-for-profit sector. And they'd gone around to a few schools, you know, had some programming in not-for-profit, and, you know, they weren't getting anything that excited them. And the head of the foundation, a man named Tim Broadhead, happened to have known David Cooperrider from some other context and ran into him in Hungary at a conference and said, you know, we want to do this program, but we're not getting much. And he said, well, you know, you've got Frances Wesley right across the street. They were in Montreal, and he hadn't gone to McGill. Why don't you call her? And so he called me up, and I didn't know who he was. I'd never really thought about foundations. And he said, could I talk to you sometime? And I just had a student cancel me, and I said, well, I don't know, you're around here, I could talk to you right now. And he was a little taken aback because this is a huge foundation. And so I went across the street, and as soon as I walked in, I knew I wasn't reading this. So I actually thought I was going
to talk to him because to give him some advice, because, and I did it because David had given him my name, and you know, I was a fan of David, so I would do things for David. So I walk in and he announces that he wants to do this kind of program, and you know, they were prepared to put up about $8 million for this program, so it was a lot of money. And I thought, it wasn't exactly in line with what I wanted to do, but it's coming to me. I know I can do it. I'm really good at designing things, and I believe in this. So I went back to McGill and sort of thought about it, and then talked to Henry Minsberg, who was still there. And he had started up a very innovative program, because he was very innovative, which was for business, for multinationals, which was called the International Masters in Practice in Management. And it was really focused on, it was like an executive MBA, and it had these different modules. And it was run through 6 universities around the world. I mean, how he managed to pull this up, I don't know, but he's a real innovator. And he had got it through at McGill, so he had this sort of program infrastructure. So I went back and talked, and he said, yeah, well, look at the infrastructure. You know, it's modular, so it's an executive MBA. People come in for these periods of time, and they're on these themes. One is, you know, the first module is the reflective mindset. They were on mindsets. The second one was the analytic mindset. The third one was the global mindset. The fourth one was the collaborative mindset. The fifth one was the catalytic mindset. You know, you could design what you wanted. And I thought, good. So I went back to the foundation and said, well, I could do it. It has to look like this. We'd want an international component, because they hadn't built that in. They were a Canadian foundation. So I would want to take everybody somewhere, you know, just to learn things. But I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about the not-for-profit sector or the foundation world. I didn't know. I'd never been involved with any of these people. I knew nothing. But I said, oh, what the heck, I'll do it. So I negotiated, you know, being a secondant to this program for about 4 years, and embarked yet again. And I ran a whole bunch of these search conferences for the volunteer sector, so I learned something about the volunteer sector, and I put together a team from across Canada of management faculty who, you know, didn't necessarily know that much about the not-for-profit, but who were really innovators in understanding management and who cared about the not-for-profit. That was my criteria, and they were a fantastic team. And we had this amazing program. I mean, it was for 150 of the, you know, executive directors and up-and-coming stars in the big, what they call the voluntary sector, so the Oxfams and the Amnesty, and then we had some smaller, very entrepreneurial, national-level voluntary sector organizations, and I could bring in anybody I wanted. I had enough money. So I brought in everybody I wanted. And it was an amazing, it was so much fun. I had the best team, and we did an amazing job. I mean, it just was such a success that, in a sense, it made the whole profile of the McConnell Foundation. They were delighted.
Is it still in existence?
No, it was always done as a project, right? And so part of that was practicing what I had started to preach, because I had to bridge the foundation world and the university world, and we're trying to bring in some of the business community, and so I was in it, and I had to create a collaboration to make this work. And I did that, you know, and I wanted to try that out. I'd never done that before in the same kind of way. So I learned something about managing an innovative team and getting them to produce this, and what my role was, and, you know, as that sort of person who managed the whole envelope. But then that ran its course, and I always wanted it to do that, because I thought, you know, it can't be sustained at this level, and it shouldn't necessarily, because it was such a high-impact program that we began to see by the third class, we were getting in people who felt they were working in a transformed context, partly because of this program. So I knew that the design would run its course, and so I always thought it should have a kind of punctuated equilibrium thing, you know. People in McGill wanted to turn this into a forever program, but I know that for something to be that influential, you can't do that. You've got to, it's you, innovative, cutting edge, you create it, you know, the faculty are incredibly fired up, they're pushing themselves, and that's what I asked them to do. I said, I want you to teach them things that 20 years from now will still seem new, like new ideas. And that means you've got to go out of your comfort zone. You have to be teaching in the classroom things that for you are still very experimental. And they agreed to do it. And so I had to give them a lot of protection, because they were taking big risks, but they had they had transformative experiences. And when we were doing the evaluation, I mean, I was brought to tears at one point, was sitting around with these people, and the faculty actually talking about how this had transformed them, because they took risks and had successes and things that they didn't know that they could have done, and they had had this intensely meaningful experience. Now, that surprised me, because as you can probably tell, I just don't have experiences that aren't like that, because that's what I believe work's about. So my whole career, give and take brief periods when I didn't think I had it right, was like that. But I discovered that for many of my colleagues it wasn't, that they actually felt they had to, they were there to communicate an orthodoxy, and that they couldn't actually combine their passion with what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And for them it was a kind of, you know, liberation experience. And of course, when you get faculty at that edge of their own passion and experimentation in the classroom, and I insist that they be good teachers. I've only picked good teachers. The classroom practically elevates off the floor. Learn that from Middlebury, you know? A good teacher never fails. It doesn't matter what they're teaching, they get it right. They're gonna transform that classroom. And if you combine that with saying, you go where your passion is, I don't care what they learn, that it, in the sense that it doesn't have to be in any textbook. It'll transform them and the voluntary sector if it's what you think is the absolute cutting edge, and you're an excellent teacher and you care more about this than anything. So that's how we're gonna design this curriculum, right? And we did, and it was fabulous. But then it came to an end, and then I was, yeah, so what next? And I could have gone back into management, and I did think about that. But by that time, Experiments and Consilience was out, and I was thinking, management. What was I ever doing in management in the first place? I mean, you know, I'm hardly a business type. I mean, I was sitting there writing articles about, you know, endangered monkeys and, you know, gorillas in Uganda and giant jumping rats in Madagascar, and my colleagues all around are writing papers about, you know, I mean, what was I doing there? And I went back in and went to a faculty meeting, and I sat there and I don't even know anybody who's here anymore, because I've been out for 5 years really doing this program. And right around then, I got this invitation to a nomination for this position. And, you know, I sat there and I thought about it, and I thought, well, I can do it. And I believe in it. So maybe I better just throw my hat in the ring, even though it was another level of challenge in the sense that I've never managed anything this big. But I thought, it's a network. It's a kind of a dean-like position, but I'm not really a dean. It's a project, has those project qualities. I really believe in it. I've learned a lot about, you know, disciplines working together, as well as about, you know, how do you get, you know, stakeholder collaboration around environmental issues. The mission of the Institute is that it's both, you know, application and this interdisciplinary issue. I could see why they wanted me. Yeah,
I can too.
And I have a very unusual profile. And I thought, well, yeah, I think I can do that. So I threw my hat in the ring, but I didn't really think I'd get it. And what happened, actually, it was a funny thing, because I threw my hat in the ring, and I made the shortlist, which didn't surprise me. That was 10 people. And then I came for what was an incredibly grueling interview with, you know, 25 people for 3 hours, at the end of which I thought, I don't think I can speak. I mean, I can't utter. And at that point, I thought, well, you know, I talked a lot about, much as I'm talking to you, about, you know, my belief and the need to be able to integrate these kinds of knowledge as being what will make the difference. I talked about, you know, that I felt these were competencies that people could learn how to do. I had learned how to do it. I taught other people to do it. I felt that, you know, interdisciplinary programs, that's what they should be about. It's not learning a lot about everything. It's about developing the capacity to do the kind of thing I do, to code break, to crack disciplines in a hurry, so that you know how to ask the right questions, so you know how to make a contribution. You know, this is to facilitate high-performance teams. I mean, these are the skills which we need. They're like transdisciplinary competencies. And we still need disciplinary specialists, but we need them to be able to do these things. knowledge production has changed, and we need to train them the skills that it takes to produce knowledge in those new ways as well as the old ones. So I talked about that. But then, you know, they asked me questions, I mean, about things like fundraising and things like, you know, management. And I didn't think I was an ideal fit for this, because I thought, I don't think I can do all those things. So I sort of expected that I might not make the next cut, which was down to the four, or I might make it, but I would because I was a woman. And I thought, you know, they've got to have a mix. So I did make the cut. When they called me, I actually had something of the same kind of sinking feeling I had when I took the job at McGill, like, oh my God, well, you know, can I really do this? And should I take this step? And this is a big door to walk through. But I thought, oh well. And I looked at the other people, and well, they were much better than I was. And I thought, you know, they look at the caliber of people they've got. So the person I knew someone here who I was pretty sure had nominated me, and he'd been part of the Resilience Alliance as well, and had been part, I'd been involved in that research team. I thought that's how my name got into this system. And so when I saw him at a conference and I said, well, you know, I'm thinking about it, but I figure it's not really serious. And he said, no, he said, you are the number one choice. He said, I think you're fairly far ahead of anybody else. And then I got really scared, and I thought, I don't think I can do this. So I actually withdrew. So I said, I can't go forward, and I said, it's complicated. And I do, I have a lot of family complications. My oldest daughter turned out to be bipolar, and this needs a lot of support. And my father is now 80. My mother died about 9 years ago, and my father is now 80. I promised that he wouldn't ever have to go to the institution because he didn't want to. He'd been in one as a child he didn't know why. He was in a sanatorium for a couple of years and never had TV. I think it was because they were so poor during the Depression, and he was probably taken away by family services. He doesn't know why. And he hates it. And so I sort of said, yeah, well. So my husband, wasn't sure he wanted. He had a chair where he was, and he didn't know. So I pulled out. And it kept bothering me, you know, over the summer, I kept thinking, just felt like one of those things. And I kept checking the website to see who'd been picked, because I knew who the other ones were, and I didn't hear anything. David Yusoff was here, who'd been my contact. But finally, I think it was around in September, I thought, well, I'm just so curious, I can't stand it. I'm going to write to him and say, well, what happened, you know? I wrote to him and said, what happened? And then, it sounds like I'm being superstitious, unless you believe in synchronicity. The day I sent him the email, the person who had been their second choice and who they'd offered it to, turned him down. And so that very day that I sent this email to David, I got a call from John Wiley saying, well, we got this inquiry email from you, and I have to tell you that we just got turned down, and you know, would you reconsider? I'll reconsider. So I came and we looked at it, and my husband at this point had realized that, you know, I did need, that there was some kind of call going on here and I needed this kind of challenge. So came down, looked at it again, decided, well, I thought I could do something here, so decided to take it. And unfortunately, and this has been an ongoing stress, I thought I could bring my father with me, and he was a vet, you know, and then it turned out that they changed the rules so that you have to have been discharged, 2 years ago, they changed it so you couldn't be covered in the VA unless you'd been discharged for medical reasons, and he wasn't. So he couldn't come, he couldn't get health coverage here. And at first I thought I wasn't gonna be able to bring my daughter. Now she did come down and spent this last year with us, and I managed to get the health insurance to cover her for that year. I don't know how long that was going to be, but anyways, so that's going on being stressed. But, you know, having arrived here, what I was trying to do was just what I said. I thought, I can hopefully help people to rethink what interdisciplinary education is, first of all. To move towards more of a competency base so that for those who want to get a master's degree, we only have graduate programs there. Mm-hmm. And for those who want to get a master's degree, they're better equipped to go out and work for corporations or NGOs because in addition to having a science background, they have some skills around collaborative management, so knowing how to bring people together, knowing how to be a sort of institutional entrepreneur on that level and create the contacts that are needed, et cetera. Knowing how to work with different kinds of knowledge sets, working with indigenous groups, working with policymakers versus working in a private sector. Those are the kind of, so they'll have a discipline, but they'll also have this. And at the level of the those going on to PhDs, you know, really get them more sophisticated about knowledge management. What does it mean to work with knowledge that is embedded in different disciplines? What are the tools and techniques we have for integrating that kind of knowledge or bridging it? How do I understand the basic structure of different disciplines in order to work effectively with those disciplines, and be able to at least make judgments about, you know, the kind of collaborators I'm taking on, et cetera. So, you know, since I've been here, I've worked with the faculty, and I think there's a building enthusiasm around that. So they're working, sort of thinking about redesigning and those programs. And I've worked very hard to see if I can reactivate stronger links between the Institute and the broader environment, people in state and municipal government, agencies, and some of the corporations. I've been working to try to see if I could create some kind of joint initiative with the business school and engineering, because I continue to feel that it's a better marriage than anybody thinks. What business has to offer science is an understanding of how to get things done. Mm-hmm. And what science has to offer business is an understanding of how to think about thinking and how to integrate, you know, really cutting edge content into management practice. Mm-hmm. And so I've got, you know, got some momentum around that. Some groups are interested in doing that. There's been more of this job than I thought, which is dean-like, which is management. Mm-hmm. And that's been both a learning curve for me and, you know, a little bit of a disconnect. Not because I can't do it, but because I don't think it's where my gifts are. Mm-hmm. And I feel fairly strongly about not wasting my time or other people's time doing things that I'm not best at, because I think there are people who are best at it, and to get the very top, that's what they should be doing. I've been trying to find some ways around that in terms of structuring, you know, other people who could carry up some of that so that I can concentrate more squarely on the things that I think that I'm best at. Madison's an amazing place. The quality and level of the faculty here is extraordinary. I have never encountered that anywhere else. And the sophistication of external groups, people in the DNR, people in the state government, people in EPA, people who fall outside the boundaries of the university, amazing sophistication. A lot of stuff, and I think, you know, given time, we can build much better bridges there. And of course, Madison is a wonderful town. It's a quite unique spot, you know.
Are you able to do any teaching?
No, and nor am I really able to do any research. It's just I haven't got time to do it, and I do miss that. I have to say, maybe for this reason, I'd say I wouldn't want this thing to be released for 5 or 6 years. There's some disconnects here. I've learned a lot. I think I'm doing good, but I'm not getting as much of the direct ability to apply what I'm best at as I thought I could at a distance. In other words, I thought I could get more hands-on than I've been able to do. And part of that is something which I couldn't see before I came here, which was the kind of governance structure here, the militant attachment of the faculty to, it's not just to having a say in anything that's programmatic, it's the sense that administrators shouldn't. And for many of the faculty, I fall into that category. So instead of being able to say, okay, I have an idea here, I can animate a team around it, and they can supply content. I don't get trouble. I'm not, you know, the same experience as being back there and directing and standing back and saying, you know, it really is there. That'll be trouble with thing belonging to the people who are producing it. But what I, the value that I can add is to provide the umbrella, provide the structure whereby it can happen, provide the general direction or, you know, or the vision, and support people trying to do it. And there are definitely people in the Institute who are completely on board. I mean, I think they're the people who were involved in the search committee and who really wanted me. A number of other people in the Institute who just don't think I should be here signing papers and being a dean and stay out of this stuff. And so that's meant that in order, you know, and I have to do the whole job, in order to do that part of the job, I have to sort of stand back in cases where I know that what I have to bring could be transformative. And I found that really frustrating.
What about the outside context? Do you think that as they grow and you're involved with more state level or even national level activities, that will happen?
Possibly it could. It possibly could, but I'm not sure how much I can remove myself in this job from a lot of this day-to-day stuff. I am the person responsible in a sense, right. You know, and so I can't just wander off, do whatever I feel like doing.
What kind of staff do you have?
Not enough.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a time of administrative constraints. If I could bring in enough money, I could certainly build that kind of infrastructure. But you know, that means that I'm spending most of my time at this point fundraising, which again is not something I can do. I mean, I'm good at connecting with people and building relationships. Finding out where they live and figuring that, and that's an important part of fundraising. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, Mike Knatter, for example, is fantastic at this. Now he has three or four fundraising people working for him, so that helps. Mm-hmm. I don't imagine this either is, it just doesn't feel like what I was born to do.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't have that sense that you have when you know you're doing what only you can do. Mm-hmm. To the best of your ability, sort of those flow experiences, and I'm not there either. So you know, significant parts of my time that I have to spend on things where I'm just not sure I'm the best person to be doing it, mm-hmm. and I do feel some frustration around those other areas. Mm-hmm. So you know, having said that, I'm not sure where I'm going to go from here. You know, I don't know whether I'm going to stay on here for a long period of time or whether I'll push to get done what I can get done with my particular abilities and then take other opportunities as they come up. You know, I'm troubled by the difficulty in carrying on my family responsibilities and my inability to solve that problem. My husband hasn't been happy here. He came in on a spousal hire, and he just has been totally disconnected. He just wanted to know, and he has to kind of beg to connect to people. Interesting, I just got a survey, results of a survey that Wisely had done on women in science here, and particularly looking at those who had left. And to my surprise, but you know, a lot of them said the reason they came here was the spousal hiring policy, and the reason they left was because their spouses weren't happy and that their spouses were drifting around in this mm-hmm. sort of, mm-hmm. like I'm the afterthought and nobody really wants me. And mm-hmm. so although I'm collecting a salary, I have no community. So he's not very happy either. So you know, that hasn't settled in a way that I can see, okay, this is functioning, this is going to work. So I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, there's things I love about being here. There's areas where I think, you know, I see things in ways that are unique and could offer this environment a competitive advantage that I think they would like to have. There are definitely people here who connect with that. But there's a break on it that in a way that I haven't experienced before, mm-hmm. among people who don't share that feel that the institute is theirs too, and I'm not faulting them on that. You know, I don't in any way feel that they're wrong to feel that. But then what that creates in me is a growing sense of, I don't fault you, but maybe there's a mismatch here, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just don't know what's going to happen around that. I am spending a lot of time looking externally right now, partly because I think I've done what I can around the programming. Mm-hmm. I've got the whole thing in motion. I can't be over-involved in it, I've learned since I got here. So although I could design it in a flash and it would be great, I can't. So I've got to let them do what they do, and I think, you know, I've got some momentum going, some people taking some leadership there. I've tried to bring in extra resources I've had. I've used to bring in PAs who can support the chairs of those committees so they can get work done, and that's worked really well. I've got a group of wonderful graduate students who really work to move those committees along and relieve the chairs of any extra work so they can get that going. So I think, you know, there will be change based on that. I think it's already undergoing. The other areas, which is building outward, we've got in place an outreach committee that's been very effective in introducing the institute. We're going to start a seminar series in the fall that will bring in speakers from outside as well as inside. I've gotten involved in the Green Tier Initiative at the state level and have gotten some of those people involved in those programs. I've initiated the business environment that's underway, and I am having some success and starting to raise funds around that. I've worked really hard at the level of the university on trying to contribute to strategy committees there, where I think I have something to offer. But I don't know, I have this feeling, just between you and me and this tape, that I don't want anybody to hear for 5 years. I have this feeling that I'm going to come to the end of my capacity to contribute meaningfully. And I'm not going to stay in a place where I'm not doing that. You know, that's not what I feel my life is about. And, you know, there are always opportunities. And at this stage in my life, I'm really lucky that way. I have an unusual enough competence and have had I say this, the depth of sincerity, the extraordinary luck and privilege of working in environments and in communities that were the best I think anybody could possibly be exposed to. And so I have lots of opportunities. Oh, yeah. And I sort of feel like, well, I don't have that many years left now. And I've got to do to those that much is given, much is expected. And I have to be using that now to make the greatest difference I can. And if I hit an environment where people are saying, well, we don't really want to do what you have to offer, then we shouldn't be wasting anybody's time. You know, I need to go where I can make that contribution, and they need to find the leader who can give them what they need. I don't feel that this was wrong. Coming here was wrong. I think it was right. Mm-hmm. I think they were right about me and I was right about them, but I feel like it's up to a point. Do you know what I mean? It's like I can do this much, but after that, you don't need or want what I have, mm-hmm. and I need to make my contribution somewhere else. Yeah. So it's been great talking to you about this because, you know, life's funny. It's a sort of a sweep. It's not all in your control, and things happen to you, and you're shaped by them, and you respond to them, and